This podcast is brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short. You can find more podcasts and other resources on our website, www.acamh.org, and follow us on social media by searching ACAMH.
I'm sure you'll agree, ASD is an important topic, and certainly nationally at the moment it is getting a lot of prominence within multiple areas, you know, NHS England, Health Education England, Public Health England, to name a few. And it's great to see the selection of speakers we have today. And we've got some really sort of high profile people here, to be honest, with regards to some of our partners for the Jack Pizzard Conference from Autistica and the National Autistic Society, and also from some of the local hospitals. So on the panel today, we have James Cusack, who's the Director of Science for Autistica. We have Anne Ovidian, who's the Principal Clinical Psychologist at Evelina Hospital, Children's Hospital in London, which is at Guy's and St Thomas's. Dr. Marinos Kyriakopoulos, if I pronounce that correctly, and Consultant Child and Adolescent Psychiatrist at South London Maudsley NHS Foundation Trust, and Carol Povey, the Director of the Centre for Autism at the National Autistic Society. Please keep your questions in mind for the panel discussion towards the end, which I'll be chairing. And during the actual talks, if you can keep those questions to yourself, and we'll be also collecting them online, and then we'll try and stimulate some debate and discussion at that point. Thank you. So first up, we have Marinos, who's going to talk about autism spectrum disorders. What do we treat and how?
Thank you, Mark, and thank you for inviting me to share some thoughts with you. I will focus more on what we treat and have a couple of slides at the end because the time is very limited, and we try to make it more as interactive as possible tonight. So I will start with sharing with you something that you all know, that autism has started from being a triad to being a dyad, and actually in the DSM-5 this has been established, and this is the way that is going to be in ICD-11. And it includes, I have a couple of slides, two or three slides, just to remind you, or perhaps to say, to think with some of you who might not be working with children with autism, that this includes difficulties with reciprocal social interaction, gaze, facial expression, interest in other children, offering or seeking to share with others, offering comfort, appropriateness of social responses, as well as difficulties in communication, including gestures, imitations of action, play, social conversation, asking inappropriate questions or statements, and language difficulties. And the third area, the second area, depending on which classification system you're referring to, includes stereotyped interests, stereotyped activities and interests, including unusual preoccupations, circumscribed interests, ritualistic behaviors, mannerisms, repetitive use of objects, and unusual sensory interests. I went through all these very quickly. I'm pretty certain that most of you are very familiar with how a child with autism spectrum disorder presents. And I wanted to focus more on the additional symptoms that children with autism spectrum disorder experience, and highlight some of the difficulties in differentiating them from some of the core symptoms of autism spectrum disorders. So quite interestingly, this slide sort of dates in the triad form before the two social impairment and communication impairment are thought to be in the same sort of direction. All these symptoms, so anxiety disorder, psychotic symptoms, disinhibition, aggression, relate to both these clusters, which now form just one cluster. And the whole additional disorders like ADHD, learning disability or intellectual disability, and language disorders can sometimes be hard to differentiate from the core constellation of symptoms in autism. Similarly, some of the stereotyped activities and interests, those who work clinically, you will know that sometimes it's really hard to tell the difference between obsessive or compulsive behaviors and ego dystonic stereotypies or ego dystonic special interests. And also sometimes the tics or jerky movements that children might have can be hard to differentiate from mannerisms, or sometimes children with neurodevelopmental disorders and autism spectrum disorders have both. Quite frequently, we have children present with what we sort of informally call mixed neurodevelopmental disorders. And I say informally because it's not a classification that is formally in any of the current classification systems. And actually, children sometimes have symptoms and difficulties along many different neurodevelopmental dimensions. Sometimes the focus depends even on the clinician's interest rather than necessarily the constellation of of symptoms that the child presents with. So sometimes someone who has more expertise in ADHD tend to see ADHD rather than autism and vice versa. But in many cases, those neurodevelopmental difficulties are not severe enough to conclusively come to lead to a diagnosis. And sometimes they are these difficulties along many dimensions can cause a significant impairment, and clinicians are finding it very difficult to conclude, to classify a child as falling into one of the categories. So just to give an example, it may be that the child has some difficulties in their reciprocal social interaction. They may have strong interests in things, and at the same time they may be a little bit impulsive, a little bit overactive. They may have some anxieties, some obsessionality, and you see the whole lot, but not necessarily in a way that you could unpick one aspect of it and call it a specific disorder. And in clinically, we see a lot of children where people in the, probably not as much in an inpatient setting where I work, where we tend to have children who present with more severe psychopathology. But in community settings, very frequently you see children with difficulties in many dimensions, but not severe enough in one dimension in order to come to the diagnosis. And of course, few children, much fewer, have significant severe enough symptoms in order to get one diagnosis, or quite frequently more than one diagnosis. So in reality, this is how it looks like on most occasions. So you have different types of symptoms that all come together in some children. Some children obviously do not have the constellation of symptoms, but you could see, I mean, unfortunately, there are only two dimensions in a slide to put these intersecting circles, but actually quite frequently you see different combinations of different symptoms in children, and this is in the context of a family and social environment, which makes it even more difficult to unpick. So what are the challenges? First of all, patients, so the children or young people, or adults for that matter, because so I keep referring to children, I work with children, actually autism and neurodevelopmental disorders span across the lifetime. But patients may be less able to vocalize their symptoms. Their behavior may not correspond to the underlying symptom. The classic example of that is a child who is aggressive or angry, and the underlying symptom is anxiety, or the underlying symptom is depression. So sometimes you see the behavior, but you do not have immediate access to the symptom that is triggering it. It may be hard to differentiate the symptom of mental illness from the neurodevelopmental deviance. I made the point already that in, for instance, obsessive behaviors and compulsive behaviors, sometimes it's really hard to differentiate whether these are behaviors that the child is enjoying or behaviors that they think they need to engage in because of their anxiety. symptoms may be less typical, and one symptom may point towards many different conditions. So, for instance, sleep disorder, you know, problem with sleep is a classic symptom that may represent, you know, may be seen across many different neurodevelopmental and mental health conditions, or eating problems might be seen across many different neurodevelopmental mental health conditions. So in reality, we need to be thinking dimensionally and categorically at the same time. So we need to be looking at what goes wrong in different dimensions, and we need to try and put everything together into a category, because this is how we're going to treat by using evidence-based interventions. So which can be a challenge, especially to start with. And there is really important to conclude on the formulation. In these children, formulation is quite frequently a working formulation. So you try to put all, conclude on what drives the behavior or what drives the disability, and then work addressing a few things at a time and review whether this is effective or not. So thinking, I'll take you through quickly some different conditions that and how they present in children with autism spectrum disorders. And I will start, I will focus more on psychosis, partly because it's my area of interest, and partly because I think it's a debate that has started in relation to some of the unusual experiences that children with autism sometimes report. And I think we, clinically at least, we see more and more of these children complaining of unusual experiences, and clinicians cannot make sense very well on what these are about. So starting from emotional disorders, this is a very busy slide. I put it up for two reasons. First, to motivate you to read the study, which is a very good epidemiological study. And the second reason is to show you that a very high percentage of children with autism have an anxiety disorder or an emotional disorder. So 80% of children with autism have an emotional disorder. Out of them, almost 78%, 79% have an anxiety disorder. And that is quite important, because if you think of symptoms, I could argue that if 80% of children have anxiety, anxiety is almost part of autism. And although autism is not, we don't have very good treatments for the core symptoms of autism, we have very good treatments for anxiety. So if 80%, so without even without even assessing the child, you know, out of 10 children with autism, 8 will have an anxiety disorder, diagnosable anxiety disorder, which gives you a lot of scope for intervention, both with the children and with their families. And you can make a real difference by treating it. So with with psychosis, probably most of you will know that autism came out of the definition of schizophrenia. So Bloiler used the word autism as one of the four characteristic symptoms of schizophrenia. And it didn't mean something very different from what we are much more sophisticated in our approach of what autism means today, but it meant this withdrawal, this lack of engagement, this lack of interaction that people with schizophrenia presented with. And I'm sure you are both very familiar with Kanner and Asperger, who are the pioneers of defining this as a separate condition. It is quite interesting that the construct of autism went through and the relationship between autism and schizophrenia went through different stages. And actually, Kanner described in 1943 infantile autism. Asperger was not known at the time. He described it around the same time, but he came to the forefront more recently with Lorna Wing. And since that time, there have been a lot of discussions. Initially, all young people with what we now call autism were classified as having psychosis, childhood psychosis, then there was a discussion about whether one scanner defined autism. Quite a lot of psychotic people were defined who presented with psychosis early in life were diagnosed with autism. Then this changed with Rutter and Colvin's work, where they were trying to understand the difference between some of the children with psychotic symptoms presenting early on as opposed to children with autism spectrum disorders. And since the 1980s and since then in the classification system, the discussion about these two conditions being separate has been developed. But they share quite a lot of symptoms. Both, and they have been found to have some underlying neurobiological dimensions that are quite similar. I will show you, I will introduce you this this paper as well, which I strongly advise you to have a read. This was published in 2009, and you may be familiar with the work that has been taking place in NIMH in childhood onset schizophrenia in the last couple of, more than a couple of decades now, so probably 3 decades now, where they are trying, they are screening US children to identify those that present with schizophrenia. Then they admitted them in a state-of-the-art facility in Washington, NIMH. They went through a series of tests, neuropsychological, clinical tests, neuroimaging, treatment trials. So they really looked into childhood onset schizophrenia very closely. And initially, there was a lot of arguments in favor of this being completely separate from or being markedly different from ASD. And with this paper, the similarities were also highlighted, and they sort of made the argument that 30 to 50% of children with childhood schizophrenia had premorbid or could be characterized premorbidly as having an autism spectrum disorder, but also that I haven't got the slide, but I strongly advise you to read this paper. The genetics, which has been developed since then quite significantly, also point out to some common genetic pathways that could be affecting both autism and schizophrenia. And in our work, we did a meta-analysis of neural correlates of social cognition, and we found that there are some circuits in the brain that are very similarly affected in schizophrenia and in autism, as well as obvious differences between the two groups. I will also introduce you very briefly to the clinical construct of multiple complex developmental disorder. This was an attempt to capture children that had comorbidities across a number of different dimensions, and it included impaired regulation of affective states and anxiety. So a little bit like anxiety disorders, and you could see fears, phobias, panic episodes, behavioral disorganization. Impaired social behavior, so more along the lines of autism spectrum disorders, although they talk about ambivalent attachments and avoidance and withdrawal despite evident competence. But we know now that children with autism are not equally affected all the time. Sometimes they are more when they are supported and when they are in a structured environment, they demonstrate competence in these areas. And also the presence of thought disorder, so irrationality, magical thinking, perplexity, overvalued ideas, so more like the thought process difficulties that one sees in psychotic conditions. So they try to look at these children separately. This construct hasn't made it into the classification systems, but because of a clinical need, we looked at the children who were admitted in our unit, because commonly they have difficulties in all these dimensions. So retrospectively, we went back 9 years and we looked at all autistic children. We excluded all psychotic children and we looked at these symptoms in their clinical presentation. And we did something that is called latent class analysis. We looked at how these different symptoms come together or differentiate children from each other. And what we found is that the best description of these children, the best classification of these children was through differentiating two classes, one with which we called the non-psychosis, ASD non-psychosis. So you could see that they differ in the psychotic symptoms, the psychotic type symptoms, because they were not psychotic. We excluded actively all children with the diagnosis of psychosis. So they are different. They were different in thought disorder symptom, and they were different in unusual or bizarre anxiety reaction, which someone could argue it is somewhere in the same along the same dimension. And we looked at other things, but I think the idea of the idea of this study came out of the idea that which is widespread, that anxiety can trigger off some of these unusual experiences, but nobody looked at it from the empirical point of view. And actually, now all our children had very high levels of anxiety. So, despite the fact that all children had high levels of anxiety, some children responded to that anxiety in a more psychotic type way compared to the rest. So I think this is something that will be worth looking at again in bigger samples and in more detail in the future. And interestingly, this group, you may remember from the slide on the symptoms, these children do not experience, the construct of MCDD does not include hallucinations as part of the children's presentation. And actually what we did, so if you could think of the MCDD group, so the children who met enough symptoms to fit the description of MCDD were almost exclusively within the children with the psychotic-like symptoms. So almost all the symptoms, all the children who met criteria for MCDD were within this group. And hallucinations were almost exclusively in the same group of children. So in reality, and so hallucinations were used as an external validator of this group. And looking at the other thing that was going through my mind at the time was that quite a lot of children with ASD that we've got present with psychotic symptoms, and colleagues that refer children to our unit are trying to understand whether these children are psychotic or not. It's much more common for these children to be diagnosed with an autism spectrum disorder. And I thought that, having an impressionistic view of my clinical work, I thought perhaps psychotic symptoms are more common in children with ASD. And then we looked at children with psychotic symptoms over a 9-10 year period, and we found that actually, in an inpatient setting, to my surprise, all children had very high levels of psychotic symptoms. And actually, as we were doing that, there were a couple of other studies that looked at psychotic symptoms in community, in children in the community who were looked after by CAMHS. And so interestingly, nothing came up. Perhaps there is a story about LD, but I won't tell you, I won't elaborate now. But when we looked at those children with psychotic symptoms, indeed ASD were those who came in more frequently. So actually, although the psychotic symptoms are not more common in ASD compared to other diagnoses, the fact that more children come into hospital because of their ASD with the psychotic symptoms make this a very interesting finding, because the same would apply in community settings. When a child comes and says, I have got psychotic symptoms, chances are they are not psychotic. Chances are that they have something else. And ASD is top of the list. So when you think about psychotic symptoms, or when you see children with psychotic symptoms, always think about ASD. Not because psychotic symptoms are more common in ASD, but because these children might present more commonly in community settings. I think I will skip a few slides because I overran. I will mention from the bipolar disorder that ASD traits have been reported in more than half of young people with bipolar disorder who do not have a premorbid diagnosis of ASD. And ASD probands have elevated risk, elevated rates of bipolar disorder. And quite interestingly, children with ASD may find it more difficult to report mood symptoms. So sometimes we may be missing children with ASD and bipolar disorder. And actually, some of the most difficult children with diagnosed on ACON LODS were these children with most commonly bipolar schizoaffective disorder who had ASD, and we couldn't come to the conclusion on whether they had bipolar disorder. They are not very common. They are very, very rare, but they are quite difficult to diagnose. Eating behaviors in ASD, you are familiar. They might be eating inedible things. They have food sensitivities and selectivity. They refuse eating. They present with eating disorders. Sometimes food refusal is part of a wider condition like pervasive refusal syndrome, which typically is considered not to be part of ASD. But in practice, a lot of colleagues are discussing cases where they look more like ASD. And they retain the diagnosis of ASD. And PDA, which is a big thing that is currently under discussion and nosologically as well as clinically. And I have two slides on treatment approaches. It's mostly about motivating you to read these papers. So this is in a recent JCPP paper where Green and Garg looked at all the mechanism targets for potential psychosocial intervention, and they looked quite. They made an argument that dyadic behaviors are particularly important. They focused their review quite a lot on that. So I strongly recommend that you read it, and also just to say. A couple of things about medication ASD. Now we have RCTs for quite a few different treatments in children who have these disorders and comorbid ASD. But we are still I think a stunning. We are still need to understand more about the about how these treatments interact. And I have included. The review paper that again you could have a look at. So in conclusion, children with ASD frequently have complex presentations which need to be further understood. Research on psychosocial behavior interventions remains limited and mostly of low quality. And the review I mentioned makes this point as well as another review in the same JCPP issue. And that there are significant gaps in research in pharmacological treatments. Thank you very much.
We have Dr. Anna Ovidian presenting on cognitive pathways to mental health problems in ASD. Okay.
Sorry, I was waiting to change presentation. I'm going to continue on the theme of complex presentations, thinking particularly about co-occurring mental health problems in autism spectrum disorder. So it's a bit of a whistle-stop tour, really, of where we were, where we are now, and where we should be going. So where we were when I started in the field about 14 years ago, and really for quite a few years after that as well, anxiety and emotional disturbance were frequently conceptualized as part of ASD, and really it was around the time pretty much that I qualified that people were really beginning to think about whether these were separable, co-occurring difficulties which required separate treatment. And as Marinos said, the treatments for core symptoms of ASD aren't brilliant or non-existent sometimes, but in terms of the co-occurring problems, we have some reasonably good treatments now. And mental health problems underlying challenging behaviour were also frequently unrecognised or misunderstood, which can lead to mistreatment as well, of course. So if somebody is acting up or, you know, presenting very challenging behaviour, they might be treated with medication when actually there might be some environmental reasons or mental health reasons driving that behaviour, such as anxiety. And then really we had few, if any, treatment options other than medication. But since then, the story's changed a fair bit. So I think where we are now, we certainly have robust data on the prevalence of mental health problems in autism spectrum disorder. So I'm referring to Emily Simonoff's paper there, 2008. There's been several since as well, but this is one of the seminal papers showing the greatly increased rates of mental health problems, in particular anxiety. Several trials we have now demonstrating the efficacy of CBT for anxiety. I've just cited one paper there, which there's meta-analyses been done because there's so many trials now. Using various methodologies, and I'll talk a little bit more about where I think we're going with treatment at the end. I think we have a better understanding of the typical and atypical presentation of anxiety and depression to a degree, and OCD in this group as well. And I think this slide is not quite all on the screen, but there should be 5 points on the slide. We've developed some ASD-specific assessment tools. So it's one of the conversations that used to be had among clinicians was, oh, measures, they don't really capture it, do they? And, you know, just in the past couple of years, really, some people have begun to develop some measures which really capture the atypical presentation of anxiety in this group. They're not yet widely available. One is a questionnaire measure, which is available online. And another one is an interview measure, which is excellent and I hope will become more widely available. And there is one more point on that slide in terms of where we're going. And anyway. So, come back to that one. So, I think in fact that was it. It was cognitive pathways to anxiety in this group is another thing that we're beginning to understand. So not just the fact that mental health problems have a much higher prevalence in this group, but we're beginning to understand a little bit about why as well. So why is it that people with autism have such preponderance to anxiety problems, for example? And it's not just a little bit of a raised prevalence, it's a lot. You know, we're talking figures of 40-50%. Some studies have found 70-80% prevalence rates of anxiety in this group, compared with figures of, you know, 5-10% in the general population. And those figures are higher than in the children with language impairment or conduct disorder, you know, various other groups of children with neurodisability. But there's something particular about autism which seems to lead to a particular preponderance in anxiety. I started my talk by saying I'm going to be talking about mental health problems. A lot of the research is on anxiety, so I will be focusing quite a bit on anxiety. So what we have found, what we do know now about cognitive pathways to anxiety and autism spectrum disorder, there's some fairly robust relationships between intolerance of uncertainty and anxiety. Executive function and anxiety as well, and also attentional bias and anxiety. So I'll talk about those each. So thinking about attentional bias then, so this is a process which has been commonly implicated in anxiety disorders in the general population. There's only been a few studies which have looked at it in autism, but what's interesting is that not only do you see a, as you would expect in children who are anxious, attentional bias towards threat information in people with autism, but even people with autism without anxiety tend to have a greater attentional bias to threats than people without autism. So it's almost as if there's something about the makeup, the cognitive makeup of people with autism that sort of predisposes them to have an orientation towards threat. So two studies there have found that relationship. So looking at the one above, autism and anxiety had similar rates of attentional bias compared to a group of children with no autism. And then looking at the next one there as well, threat faces, similar sorts of findings. So intolerance of anxiety was the next thing that I was going to focus on. And again, it's a small but robust literature. Looking at the relationship, or possibly causal relationship, between intolerance of uncertainty and anxiety. Intolerance of uncertainty being exactly what it says it is, an intolerance of uncertain situations, and closely related to the difficulties of change, difficulties of change of routine that we see in this group, the insistence on things staying the same. And studies have found, for example, a relationship, direct relationship between the greater insistence on sameness, which is associated with higher anxiety, so just looking at questionnaire measures, finding a correlation between the two, And that led the authors to think about whether repetitive behaviours have a different function in this group, which may not just be about emotion regulation, as people have previously thought, but also maybe it's about creating sameness. So, you know, when you're engaged in repetitive behaviour, you know what's going to be happening as long as you're doing that in repetitive behaviour, if that makes sense. It creates a sort of sameness, which can then lead to positive beliefs about repetitive behaviour, possibly reducing learning opportunities. And there's another study found that comparing a group of children with and without autism and the anxiety, they found that the anxiety was almost completely accounted for by intolerance of uncertainty. So when they took out the intolerance of uncertainty variable, there was very little difference between the groups in terms of anxiety. So suggesting that in autism, that may be a particular cognitive pathway from autism to anxiety. And are we looking, though, at more than just intolerance of uncertainty? Is there intolerance of all sorts of things in this group? So, for example, an intolerance of discomfort, intolerance of their internal state. So, for example, people may have worked with people with autism who get excited and then that tips over into anxiety and they can't cope with the sort of arousal that comes with excitement. Or, for example, when you're talking to children about things which might cause them embarrassment or shame, and then they start acting in a challenging way because they just can't tolerate that feeling. Or again, is it intolerance of external stimuli as well? So the sensory difficulties that we see, the difficulties again with change. So recently, there's been a great proliferation of interest in emotional regulation. So emotion regulation being an emotional response the emotional response requires emotional regulation, and emotional regulation is defined as the efforts to then modify or control your response to that emotional reaction. So usually focusing on a particular goal. And adaptive emotion regulation strategies would involve things such as reappraisal, problem solving, but emotional dysregulation may present as meltdowns, irritability, aggression, self-injury, impulsivity, depression or rumination, avoidance of difficult emotions, and of course anxiety. And there's some studies now which have shown that individuals with autism use adaptive strategies such as cognitive reappraisal less frequently, and maladaptive emotion regulation strategies such as avoidance more frequently in the management of negative emotion. And there may also be a rigidity there, which is once there is a strategy that someone feels comfortable with, then they revert to that strategy all the time. There may be a failure to learn more adaptive strategies, which poses a challenge for the therapist. And so Susan White and colleagues have proposed two pathways to anxiety via impaired emotion regulation, which I shall show you in this model. A direct pathway from autism to anxiety via impaired emotion regulation, and then a less direct route via moderators, including attentional bias, which we just discussed, other information processing difficulties such as rigidity, social motivation, social confusion, etc., which can basically make the anxiety worse or better. And this is another way of conceptualizing emotion regulation difficulties in this group, which places the emotion regulation in the center, in a sense. So it's a different way of thinking about it. So thinking about at the bottom there, psychiatric conditions feeding into emotion dysregulation. It's kind of almost like a cyclical relationship, not just emotion regulation causing psychiatric difficulties such as anxiety. It thinks about how the information processing difficulties can feed into emotion dysregulation and cognitive factors, which we've talked about a little already. And also then thinking at a brain level as well, and I'm going to spend very little time talking about this, but how there may be something different at a neurological level which causes anxiety problems in this group. So for example, one study has found that there's a reduced heart rate and cortisol response to psychosocial stress in people with autism, which is a pattern which is quite similar to people who have experienced chronic stress, a sort of PTSD type response, including early childhood maltreatment, which is interesting because it suggests that it's almost as if the world is quite a stressful place right from birth, and actually dealing with that stress leads to this altered physiology which produces a different response to anxiety. There's also some research at the sort of structural level, looking at abnormal prefrontal cortex function and also abnormal connectivity between the prefrontal cortex and the amygdala. So the amygdala being part of the brain which actually generates and moderates emotions, the frontal cortex obviously being the part of the brain which helps us to organize ourselves, helps us to plan, helps us to think about what we're doing and what we're thinking and feeling. And if those two parts of the brain aren't communicating with each other, then you can see how there might be some dysfunction there. And the role of cognitive rigidity is something that's been talked about, but not researched very much. But there's lots of thinking about how rigidity might lead to mental health problems in this group. Rigidity may in fact lead to intolerance of uncertainty, because if you're rigid and you want things done a certain way and then you're faced with uncertainty, that might cause you some anxiety. Rigidity can inhibit the development of flexible, adaptive strategies to managing stress. As I mentioned, people may have one go-to strategy, which may be I hit my mum when I get stressed. It might not be a conscious thing, but that might be what happens. And there may be a bi-directional relationship between rigidity and anxiety. So people who are getting anxious may then become more rigid and then resulting in insistence on sameness, as well as rigidity preventing the effective management of anxiety. The role of alexithymia has been discussed and received a fair bit of interest recently as well. Alexithymia being characterized by difficulties identifying, expressing, and feeling emotional states. And there's been some proposals that the emotional impairments, such as impaired emotion recognition in others and reduced empathy seen in autism, might be the result of co-occurring alexithymia. And the relationship between anxiety and features of ASD has also been shown to be mediated by alexithymia. And in fact, a lack of reactivity to inner experiences was found to be a powerful predictor of anxiety and worry in adults with ASD. So again, most of these studies are finding very significant relationships. And so people have been trying to explain why then, why do these things cause such great anxiety? I think it's been nicely summarized in this model here, whereby atypical sensory function and alexithymia, which are highly related, in fact, difficult sensory function may, atypical sensory function may lead into alexithymic type difficulties. And then rigidity there as well, which all feed into the intolerance and uncertainty, which may lead to the restricted, repetitive thoughts and behaviours and anxiety symptoms that we see. So where we are now, I was talking a little bit about treatments. Adapted CBT, as I mentioned, there's been lots of trials showing the efficacy of adapted CBT for this group. A lot of the trials have adopted group approaches, but now we're seeing more studies involving individual approaches as well. So adaptive CBT would involve using lots and lots of visual supports to support your communication and to support their communication and understanding of the concepts. It also reduces the social pressure. So if you're using a whiteboard or you're using various visual sort of supports, there's less of a pressure to interact and have that conversation and make eye contact, etc. Adaptive CBT may include enhanced emotion recognition training, and you may want to involve regular breaks to take into account attentional differences. Closer involvement of parents, which I think is key, both directly in therapy and to address systemic factors as well. And you may want to include overt reinforcement for engaging activities such as behavioural experiments, really simple sort of reward strategies to encourage things there. And then mindfulness-based cognitive therapies. There's very few studies, but what there are suggesting that this could also be a very effective treatment for this group, and nice alternatives to CBT, which doesn't work for everybody. And it enhances an awareness of inner experiences, so addressing those alexithymic difficulties without attempting to change them or judge. So there's also several studies on mindful parenting for ASD as well. So where I think we're going, there's still a lot of work to be done in terms of understanding the risk factors and also variation of expression of mental health problems in this group. Certainly anxiety has received a lot of attention. Depression is beginning to receive a fair bit of attention. But I'm wondering if in the same way that anxiety was overshadowed by autism, depression is almost being overshadowed a bit by anxiety. And I quite often find when I'm treating people, the depression is secondary to anxiety, as in living with anxiety is so difficult that it can cause low mood. But it's also making me wonder whether or not, because anxiety can be so overt, whether that's overshadowing slightly more difficult to detect depression symptoms. We're heading towards wider availability of standardization of autism-specific assessment tools. And also, we could be moving towards the development of objective measures using involving physiological measurement as well. We are moving towards research-informed interventions. So, for example, CUES, which is a CBT focusing specifically on intolerance of uncertainty. Imagery-enhanced CBT, imagery being one of my pet subjects, and that's a separate talk in itself. And also, particularly, interventions targeting rigidity. There's no evidence for this at the moment, but certainly in the eating disorders population, cognitive remediation therapy is receiving some attention. And then we could also, I think, do with some trials comparing treatment approaches, identifying what works for whom, and particular medication and CBT as well. And that's a big hole in the literature at the moment, I think, for this group. And I think that's it.
Research delivered for autistic people.
So hello everyone. My presentation today is really a bit of a description of what Autistica does as an autism research charity. And then what I've also done is describe some of the projects that we're currently funding, just to give you a bit of a taste of what sort of things that we support are, and to give you a bit of an insight into that. So it's a presentation of two halves. So it's a bit about our own research strategy, then a few samples of what we're trying to do in terms of practically funding research projects. So I'm a director of science at Autistica. I'm responsible for our overall research strategy. And we have a vision where autistic people and their family members can live a long, healthy, happy life. And our theory behind that is that these three outcomes are the really three key ones to target in people on the spectrum and their family members. So we know, tragically, that life expectancy is lowered in autism. So if you're on the spectrum, you're 2.5 times more likely to die earlier, and your average life expectancy is reduced by 16 years. And that's not just because of one specific reason. We know that across all causes of death, that's the case. We also know that, as Marinos and Anne have really covered comprehensively, that mental health is a real serious problem for people on the spectrum. But this also extends to physical health as well. So there's inequalities there in terms of general access to physical health care. And we see poor physical health outcomes in autism in areas like diabetes, which you wouldn't really expect in autism. It's only recently that we really came to understand this in the research literature. And then perhaps the most fundamental thing of all, which we're all striving to do, which is to live a happy life and to ensure that we have a good quality of life. And what we see is that if you look at the markers of quality of life, we all take for granted. So being feeling included in society, feeling valued in society, feeling like you've got a job, feeling like you've got an opportunity to contribute in whatever way that is. That doesn't necessarily mean to be have a job. It could be any form of social participation. It could be being a member of a club. That people on the spectrum aren't necessarily getting those opportunities, and it's really relating to the first two outcomes that we've talked about as well. So we don't talk about these outcomes for no reason. We talk about these outcomes because we think that research is a real powerful tool to address these outcomes and to really change the future for autistic people and their family members. But to do that, we really need a plan. And so one of the things which we're really proud of, which we've recently launched, is our autism research network called Discover. And the aim of Discover, it really sits at the heart of everything that Autistica does. It's really the central part of our research strategy. And it's really about a move for Autistica from not just being an autism research funder, so a funder who funds specific discrete projects, but really to support autism research in the UK more broadly, to drive progress, to ensure that research is not just this thing that gets published in the journal, but to ensure that all the necessary steps are taken so that it really impacts and meaningfully improves the lives of the families that we serve. Because one of my frustrations, and I think one of the frustrations of many people in autism research and people who have been engaged in autism, has been that we haven't, you know, we haven't seen the impacts that we want to see from autism research yet. And I think that that's a real great shame, because actually we're seeing evidence-based interventions being developed, but they're not being disseminated appropriately. They're not being ingrained in policy as effectively as possible. And what we really want to do for Discover is to ensure that that path to implementation is as smooth as possible, but also to ensure that autism research is done as intelligently as possible, so that we're encouraging collaboration, we're encouraging autism researchers to work together, we're getting those large trials which you really need to show that something is effective or not effective. So that's the number one goal. We've got to boost autism research in the UK, really drive it forward, ensure that autism research is having the biggest impact possible. The second aim is to really maximise involvement at all levels. So we've really seen a particular need in autism, which you maybe don't get in other medical conditions, to really have meaningful involvement, to really design intelligent research. So I'm our director of science, like I say, so I see all the research applications that come in, and many fail for many reasons. And one of the main reasons that an application can fail is because it really fails to understand what the life of a family is. So they don't really understand the needs of parents. They design this intervention, which is like, you will spend 30 hours a day working on this minor outcome. And for parents, it's like, well, it's really difficult for them to spend that amount of time. And so you need parents and people feeding back on that, or you need someone on the spectrum looking at specific parts of the protocol. So like, are they using the right outcomes? Are they focusing on the things that matter to people and their families? And so what we've really seen is that to design the best research, you need meaningful involvement at all stages of research. And so Discover can really help with that. And it all can also ensure that when we're involving people, we're not involving the same people. We're being really representative in terms of our involvement. So we've got to a stage when we're involving people, we are involving people in research. The next thing that we want to do is to ensure that we're involving people with complex needs, that we're involving people who are underrepresented in terms of socioeconomic groups and different ethnicities and so on. So we've got very ambitious objectives. It's really what we try to do at Autistica, because we know that we've got a lot to do to really drive forward autism research. So these are the objectives that I wrote in our research strategy and keep me up at night. So we've got this objective to get 20,000 autistic people and their family members involved in research. I should say that's by 2021, so we do have a deadline. We want to ensure that the voices of autistic people and allies are heard at every stage of research. We want to really see a change, which means that we're driving evidence-based and research-led services. We think that families deserve the right to have the best evidence available, and that in the case of autism, that hasn't happened as much as it could have. There's an opportunity for research to change that. We want universities to work together across the UK. We're seeing a culture change across other areas of research, and it also needs to happen in autism. And we've seen from learning from other areas which are very different to autism, like cancer and dementia, that when you bring that collaborative approach, that's when you really drive forward progress. We also want to train the next generation of autism researchers to be the best they can be. We know that's really, really key. And finally, and most importantly, we need a national research strategy. So we need to be working together to really drive forward autism research and to develop that impact. And so what we hope that we can do at Autistica is help make that happen. So how do we know what to study and where to focus our efforts? It's a really, really key question. It's particularly key in autism, because we know that there has been some degree of dissatisfaction in terms of where resources have been focused for autism research. So there's a range of reports, one from Autistica, one from Research Autism, which really showed that there was a sense from families in the community that research wasn't really focusing on the areas which were really important to people. People were feeling like, how is this going to impact on the outcomes which are really important to me ultimately? And like I said earlier, we all want to see this research which drives an improvement in outcomes. So we did this very codified consultation in partnership with the National Autistic Society and other autism charities. And what we tried to do is, objectively as possible, understand what the top 10 questions for autism research should be. So first of all, we asked people to submit their top 3 questions. That would, I think, resulted in something like 3,300 questions we had submitted from about 1,250 people. We had to break those down, and we got to about 128 unique questions. And then we took the top 40 and we sent them out to the public again, and we said, pick your top 10. Then we had a top 25. And that took us to a workshop where we had equal numbers of clinical professionals, autistic people, and family members, predominantly parents, but also siblings as well. And so before this workshop, I was extremely anxious. And one of the reasons I was really anxious was because there was real disagreement between the parents and the autistic people in terms of what the priorities for autism research should be. So I was wondering what would happen when we got everyone into the room to discuss these top 10 priorities. And it was a difficult process, but we did actually come to some really nice agreement. So here are, I've just taken the keywords out because obviously it's hard to fit all the questions on a slide. But if you Google Autistica and priorities, research priorities, you'll find the detailed questions. So you've got, so really what you find is when you ask people about what the priorities are for research, they focus on outcomes or types of services. So you've got services number 10, number 9, about, you know, how do we understand and improve sensory processing, employment, adult diagnosis, family support. So how do we support families to support a child on the spectrum? How do we adapt the environment so it's optimal for autistic people? And then, quite interestingly, number 4 is anxiety, and number 1 is mental health. And that is because it was felt that anxiety within the context of mental health was such an acute issue, it needed to be a specific priority in its own. Number 3 is social care. And that's a really interesting one because when I reviewed research into adult social care and autism, there really isn't a lot of it. Actually, what we're seeing is that this is a real big issue for people, particularly as we come to acknowledge that, you know, we're not really focusing on autism across the lifespan sufficiently. That's been a massive focus for us as an autism research charity. Second one is not too surprising either. It's on language and communication. And this year, as an organization, we're really focusing a lot of our efforts on this theme. So we are doing a call for proposals to try and find new ways to support parents and people on the spectrum to address language and communication difficulties. It's actually been surprisingly under-focused. It's been surprisingly under-focused area of research within autism. So we're trying to get research in that area started. And then the top one is mental health, which is not surprising. So I think both Marinos and Anne have really actually described the fact that mental health in autism is a real serious issue for many people on the spectrum. So if you look at children on the spectrum, you're looking at, from Emily's seminal study, about 70% of children in a primary school classroom will have a mental health problem, and 50% of those will have a serious anxiety disorder. And I think for me, that's quite shocking, because what it really shows is the impact that has on them in the classroom. So it's about the capacity to concentrate, the capacity to be able to cope in a classroom, and that really affects their long-term outcomes as well. And that continues into adulthood as well. So, you know, going back to my key thing, I'm biased. I work for an autism research charity. My belief is that research is a very powerful way to change things. So if we can develop that evidence and that knowledge base, we can really, really target these outcomes, which are obviously so important to our community.
This podcast was brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short.